My brothers and sisters, how are you today? There's some people milling about in the back, so there's a couple of spots up here. And there's even a couple people with a lap that they would be willing to... No, that's awkward. That's bad. I didn't say that. But there are some seats up here, and frankly, there's seats up here if you want a really good spot. As we do every week, the ushers are going to come forward. If you came prepared to partner financially with what God is up to in and through this beautiful people, there's lots of ways of entrusting things that actually matter to you. Finances would be but one of those things. So as they come forward, that's what the bag with handles is about. All right. And while they're doing that, we're going to jump right in to the second commandment. If you missed last week, to open up this 10-week series on the Ten Commandments, you can go to crosspoint.org/messages and get caught up there online if you'd like. But we're going to dive into the second commandment given to Moses to give to the people who had been freed from Egyptian slavery. And it reads this way, Exodus chapter 20. You will not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or the waters below. You will not carve for yourself images that reflect some kind of deity, things found above, below, or anything in between. You won't do it. Now, idols were not a new idea by the time this is written at Sinai in this point in history. Every culture, every time human beings have gotten together in history, they've tried this. How do we mitigate the sense of not having control? How do we get some kind of autonomy over our own life? Let us make some kind of image that functions as a kind of a cosmic remote control. Some kind of set of buttons that we can use to conjure spirits, gods, other entities on our behalf. What are we going to do? How do I make sure that the crops are going to be good this year? How do we make sure that we get rain that we need? How do we make sure that our daughters have the babies that they need to for our name to continue? How do we make sure that the daughters of other men marry our sons and are fruitful? How do we make sure that we're victorious in war? All of that stuff, how do you control any of that? How do you understand any of that, especially in a primitive culture? How do you understand any of that? So that all of that lack of understanding, all of that ignorance, it's painful. And so idols, carved images, give you some sense of control over a seemingly otherwise chaotic universe. And these people had just come out of Egypt. And so all these gods, these half animals, half bird, half man, half alligator, half man, all the bugs and the spiders and birds and reptiles and all these images that represent the dozens and dozens of deities that Egypt upheld, God says, okay, I'm going to shake all of that loose from you. And the second command is very much, and you'll notice this week, is very much connected to last week, because the first and second commands, they dance together pretty well. You will not make images that represent deities. You will not do it. Everybody tries it. Everybody's done it. You have done it. You have grown up in a culture that does it. This faith comes from Abraham, whose father was employed to do it. Abraham's father, remember, that's what he did for a living. He makes idols. Don't do it. You will not do it. There's an interesting story. You get Abraham, then Isaac, and then Jacob. And Jacob is running for his life at one point. He's out in the middle of nowhere. Out in the wilderness, falls asleep and has a dream, and then the Lord speaks to him and says, hey, you know the promise I made to Grandpa? It's still alive. Your offspring will bless the whole world. They'll be fruitful. You'll have to number them by referencing sand and stars in the sky. That's still on. I'm going to be with you. That's still on. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm with you. Jacob wakes up and he says, surely the Lord was in this place and I didn't know it. I thought God could only be found in a shrine on top of a mountain, in a temple. I haven't invented synagogues or churches yet, but something like that. That makes sense that the divine would be encountered. But I'm out in the middle of nowhere, asleep on a rock, and I just had an interactive experience with the eternal. The Lord was in this place and I had no idea. He could be found nowhere. Right here, I had no idea. So sets up this little pile of rocks and pours oil on it and says, boom, Bet El. He doesn't call it El, God. He calls it Bet El, house of God. So he's not making an idol, but he says, this, he's really excited. You can tell in the text, Genesis chapter 28, this is no less than the gate of heaven. This is the house of God. And so he makes this little shrine so he can remember. This is the house of God. Was it really the house of God? No. No, God doesn't live there. He kind of missed the point of his own excitement. So this simplification, this distortion of the experience, he calls, this is the house of God. And God's like, no, I'm kind of an everywhere God. There's this other episode in Exodus chapter 32. While Moses is on the mountain receiving the commandments, the people down below at the base of the mountain, they're starting to get a little fidgety. Where's Moses and where's God? Like, we were just brought out a month or two ago from Egypt, and now we seem to have no leader. And they start to panic. There's an anxiety, an unrest. They don't know what to do. All the while Moses is up having a conversation with the Almighty God. They're down below going, well, what do we do? And you can feel the anxiety starting to rise. And in Exodus chapter 32, it reads this way. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming back down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come on, make us gods who will go before us. As for this dude Moses, he brought us out of Egypt. We don't know what happened to him. And Aaron answers them, okay, take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. This is his response. Yeah, I know. Bring me your jewelry. So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and he made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, a baby cow, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And there's no text that says that the people were like, are you serious? They swallow this whole thing. Okay. Hey, remember coming out of Egypt and that whole thing? Yeah, it was this. And I was wearing that earlier today. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there'll be a festival to Yahweh. Remember, Lord in all caps means in the original Hebrew, it's God's name, not his title. It's Yahweh. It's thought to be pronounced Yahweh. Tomorrow we'll have a festival to Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Today, why don't we bow down to our jewelry? Tomorrow, you know, it never happened. It's total abstraction. Tomorrow never comes. Right now, you feeling anxious? You feeling like we've lost control? You've lost your center? Things have become a little bit chaotic? You're feeling not at rest? Okay, let's just do something. And they make a calf and they throw a party and they bow down and they worship it. This is what happens. See, with Jacob, he's embracing not knowing. At least he's celebrating, I didn't know this. I just learned something about God. I thought I had God pegged, but it turns out he's an everywhere God. He kind of misses the point and says, boom, now this is the house of God. And God's like, okay, well, this is going to take some work, but we're making progress. In the second scenario, they feel very anxious about mystery. They feel very anxious about unresolved, undefined. The first is commemorating the holiness of unknowing. The second is people destroying that. No, 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 no. We can't not know. And so they make a distortion. They settle for something else. One commemorates mystery. One seeks to destroy it. So what happens to a people who refuse to embrace mystery? What happens to a people that would rather have definition outside of God's will than ambiguity and mystery within? What happens to a people that fear not knowing, fear not being able to hold on and have control and being able to predict? What happens to a people that just can't stand to have more questions than answers? I'm not just talking about people in history, am I? What happens to a people that just can't live with that ambiguity? They've got to have definition, even if it takes, okay, I know this is stupid, but I'm going to bow down to my earrings. At least that gives me some sense of control. What happens to a people that take the infinite and try to make it finite, that take the boundless and the eternal and try to make it something you can understand and predict? What happens to people after generation, after generation, after generation? Here's how the actual full text of the second commandment reads. Don't make for yourself idols in the form of anything in heaven or on earth and the waters below. You will not bow down to them or worship them, for I, Yahweh, am your God. I'm a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation to those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love and keep my commandments. It's one of those texts that you wish you want to highlight with a black Sharpie. Is this really in the Bible? What happened to the unconditional love thing? Let me help you out a little bit here. I'm a jealous God. The word is an anthropomorphic projection. That'll win you big points if you're playing a word game later. It's an anthropomorphic way of describing God's emotion. That means it humanizes God a little bit so that you can grasp him a little bit and kind of understand how God is feeling. But this is this word is used of a husband that's just found out his wife is cheating. It's a fidelity sense. His face is blood red with, are you kidding me? You've been cheating on me. It's supposed to put you in mind of a lack of fidelity. Now, we don't believe that God is a broken, shattered ego that way, but it also makes clear that God's not indifferent. Our fidelity matters to him because he loves us, and he knows infidelity isn't just a threat to his ego. It threatens us. It hurts us. So he's not indifferent about it. I'm a jealous God as a way of saying, I really do care what you believe and how you act. I'm a jealous God punishing the children for the sin of the fathers. Now, later on in Ezekiel chapter 20, it's very clear. Ezekiel says, children will not be put to death and punished for the sins of their fathers and grandfathers. Everybody has to deal with their own stuff. It's made very clear later on in the Old Testament. The actual terminology, punishing the children, it actually is visiting the iniquity or tending to the guilt of the fathers on children for generations to come. In other words, this will matter for multiple generations, and I am going to be dealing with it. Nobody's going to get killed, slaughtered, smited. That's not the issue. I will be tending to the guilt of fathers via their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren. You have to understand, people had kids very young back then, so the picture is a great-great-grandfather looking his great-great-grandson in the eye and going, I did this to our family. I took us down this path. I'm the reason that we're so disconnected between us and from God. I did this. I was so obsessed with having control. I was so scared of mystery. I couldn't live with a lack of definition that I settled for this abstract thing, this distortion of God, just so that I could get my hands back on it. I did. Some of you know exactly what that is because you inherited a very toxic view of God. It was passed down to you. What it means to be good, what it means to be holy, what it means to be loved by God, and how you get, it's passed down. Your whole family believes it. And God is still tending to the iniquity of your forefathers. It's generational. That's how significant this is. And some of you know firsthand how that works. And God says, I will continue for generations to deal with it until they wake up and realize that what they've settled for is a distortion. For the illusion of control. God says, I'm not going to let them get comfortable with their templates. And that's what we're talking about. An idol becomes not just a representation of the thing. In many religions, that's what an idol is. It's a representation of something else, or it becomes the thing during a ritual, and then it goes back to the idol. But what happens with idols, and what happened then, and still happens now, an idol becomes a template. And pretty soon, the template becomes the locus of power, the locus of worship. It becomes the thing to fixate on. So it no longer becomes representative or a substitute. It becomes the thing. And God says, I don't want you to create these templates. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, it says, you heard the voice, but you saw no form. There was no form to see, therefore do not create. And it reiterates the second commandment. There's nothing to make. Anything that you make will be a distortion of reality. It may make you think that you feel better because you have control, but it's a distortion. And then that distortion becomes a template that you put over your face, over your ears, and in your mind. And then when reality shows up, you'll go, that doesn't match what I've gotten used to. And you won't recognize reality. Understand that Jesus was crucified because he didn't match. Well, that's not what messiahs look like. No. You're supposed to free us from Roman occupation. No, you're supposed to come with a sword and chop people up. No. Kill him. Well, he's got babies on his knee and he's talking about love. Kill him. He doesn't match. Understand that the Jewish men and women that had him crucified, they never made an idol. They would have been disgusted by that accusation. But they had one inside. They had a template, and Jesus didn't match. Many of us right now are thinking, you know, out of the 10, at least number 2, I've never messed up. I've never went and whittled me something and then made an offering to it. I struggle maybe with 7 and 8, but 2, I've never done that one. So I at least get a pat on the back for getting this 90% right. But don't be really cautious when your spirit exempts you. Be very cautious when you exempt yourself. Oh, I could never do that. You have to understand, many of us have an idolatrous spirit, but we apply it to church. That a certain kind of church, a certain kind of denomination, or a certain offshoot of a denomination, or a non-denominational offshoot of a denomination, a certain kind of room, a certain kind of setting, a certain kind of music, a certain kind of way of speaking, a certain kind of way of dressing or not dressing, that thing becomes the holiest thing about your faith. People do this with doctrine. Oftentimes people will come and ask one of their first questions about a church when they're just getting started with the church, they move into town or they switch churches or they start going to church or whatever. But their first questions are, what does this church believe? What is your stance on? And then they list their pet doctrinal issues. And it's idolatrous. Many times, sometimes it's just a pure hearted, hey, I got really wounded at a church. I want to make sure that's not present here. But oftentimes it's idolatry. Hey, this thing is the most important. What people very seldom do is go to a church and say, hey, is the Spirit of God moving here? Hey, what beneath the form and the fashion of how you guys do it, tell me about God's Spirit. They don't oftentimes ask that. They ask, what do you believe about? What is your stance? What is your do you have a doctrinal statement I can pour through before I make my choice? And oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes, doctrine becomes a god. It's an idol. We do it with the Bible. The Bible takes God's place. The Bible somehow has the authority that the Holy Spirit is supposed to have. My interpretation of it, or my interpretation of this specific translation of it, and it gets lifted up higher and higher and higher. We do it with prayer. We do it with church. We do it with doctrine. We do it with a certain emotion, going and trying to find this experience. I had this experience, man. I was at a camp 20 years ago when I was a teenager, and I'm still trying to find that experience because that was real. I can't find my little heap of stones with oil on it. That Beit El, I'm trying to recreate because that was the moment that God was real. And I am constantly trying to recreate something that happened in the past. And it becomes an idol. Certain behaviors, a code of conduct can be an idol. This is how you act if you want God to love you. You better stop this and certainly stop saying those 7 words or God won't show up. Your ability to conjure, to influence, to manipulate is connected to a thing and no longer the person. Here's the great acid test. Ask yourself if the thing that you hold most sacred even needs God at all. Because God, in all these scenarios that I've listed out and all the ones you're smart enough to list out, God could leave. He could pull up his stakes and leave, go to another planet, start a whole other thing, and you wouldn't notice because your icons, your idols, your notions of how things and how he and how the universe should work, they're still in place. They're still defended. They're still being worshiped. They're still being compared and contrasted. God could leave and you wouldn't know it. So this is super, super important. And I think there's an unhelpful distinction that gets made about the Ten Commandments. And it's not evil. I just don't think it's helpful. People say, okay, there's 10 commandments. The first 4 are about your relationship to God. The next 6 are about your relationship to others. You cannot make that distinction. Your relationship to God is your relationship to people. Your relationship to people is your relationship to God. John says in the New Testament, if you claim to love God and then you're hateful to a human being, you're a liar. They're connected. Love of God, love of people, they are connected. And so the first 4 are very indicative of how you are treating people at the same time. And so with this in mind, understanding that creating an idol, idolatry, is attempting to call the universe into predictable conformity with your tastes, preferences, comforts, and will. I'm trying to get the outside universe, namely God, to agree with me. to be conjured, influenced, even controlled. Idolatry, not very different really than a voodoo doll. I'm trying to maintain some semblance of control in a seemingly otherwise chaotic universe. But that means if you'll do it to God, you'll do it to people. Because the way that you see and treat God, the way that you experience and understand God, is a chief determiner of how you relate horizontally with all the other human beings. They're connected. They're absolutely connected. You automatically treat people the way that you treat God. I went to the beach this past week, and it was kind of an impromptu last minute, let's take the kids to the beach before school. My three children are on a traditional cycle for school, and so they've got just a few more weeks before they start. Hey, let's head to the beach. So we head to the beach, got a cheap hotel out there, and went, you know, we hadn't been to the beach this year, which back in Ohio, that sounds like, I think that's child abuse, but here it's 2 hours away. I don't know why we don't do that more. And so 2 hours away, we go, and Friday, it was kind of our last day of a very short trip, and we walk out onto the beach, and the wind is blowing not just hard, but sideways. Like, you can't see, and I don't have any hair on my legs. That's a true story. It's like a sandblaster just cutting across. So we lay out, you know, our sheet, and then we've got the cooler holding this side down, and then a little, you know, net bag of towels here, and then a couple other things here in our sandals. Within 20, 30 minutes, it was like an ancient archaeological site, completely buried in sand. We've got pickaxes. Where's my bottle of lotion? But you didn't need lotion because the sky was gray black. I mean, this is a storm coming in off. It's like two storms converging. The waves, they're coming straight in and sideways. And so, you know, my son, who's 6 years old, he weighs, you know, maybe 40 pounds. You put him in the water and he's at Myrtle Beach, you know? Just unbelievable. All these weird currents. Daddy, why can't we play in the ocean? We're at the ocean. Because it's dangerous. Other kids are playing in the ocean. Well, their parents don't love them like we love you. And so it's, listen, this beach trip is not, it's shaping up to be frustrating. It's shaping up to be disappointing. And so I'm walking back and forth. My wife lays a chair out and she's laying, staring into the sky going, this is pointless. You know, there's no sun to be found and the wind keeps cutting across where, you know, the kids are bending down making castles and they're squinting because their eyelids are filling with sand. Daddy, I can't help you. And so I'm pacing back and forth. I'm not angry, but I'm realizing, man, this stinks. And then I had this kind of this aha kind of moment. My issue was, I forgot that this is what the beach is like. Some of you, you've lived maybe on the ocean or you go more than the once a year kind of thing. You understand the beach isn't always a sunny place with one slightly bent over palm tree, is it? Seasons and weather happen at the beach just like here, huh? See, in my mind, I had created a template of a beach. And so when you, this beach, where you walk up to and there's nobody else there. And you walk up and the sky is blue and a seagull goes by and kind of winks at you. And the sand castles are 8 feet tall and they'll stay there for a year. And the tide gently comes in unless you're surfing. And then it's that one spot. It's really, I had this template of a beach. The problem was I was at the beach. And I was frustrated because I had this template over my eyes and in my mind. And it was failing to conform to the template of a beach in my mind. And when I realized that, that's the power of awareness, by the way, because when I dropped this template, when I just put it down, instantly I realized, oh, it's not frustrating. I frustrated me. It's not disappointing. I disappointed myself. When I dropped the image, then I was suddenly able to experience reality. Then I could actually enjoy the real, raw, untamed, unbridled beach as it was. Oh, this is the other part of beach weather. We had a great time. But not until I dropped my template so that I could actually see and experience reality. I had to stop asking life to conform to my preferences before I would be satisfied with it. I dropped it and suddenly was experiencing reality. Had a great, great time. How many wives complain about their husbands? They say, my husband is not the man I married. He's not a spiritual leader. And within that same couple of sentences, we'll reference their own father or somebody else's husband. And he'll perform. He'll tap dance his heart out trying to be the man that she has in her mind, but he can't be that. And so year after year after year, they both grow bitter. Because why? Because she's got a template of what a husband should look like, to the extent that when she looks at her husband, she can't even see him anymore. All she sees is failure. All she sees is her template and his lack of alignment. How many husbands bemoan not having the wife that they thought they had back in college? She's turning out not to be the sexual creature that she seemed to imply she would always be. Now she's interested in the details of bills and life and plans. Ugh, she's kind of nagging me. How many husbands are complaining about their wife by referencing a wife? They can't even see their wife anymore because they have a template of what a pretty, conforming, good, cool wife should be. And she can never be that because that's not what she is. That's not who she is. And they both grow bitter. How many children bemoan their parents? And in so doing, have to reference somebody else's parents. Or this template, this idol that they have created in their minds that their parents could never be. And no matter how many times they read passages that all have stumbled and sinned in many ways. Yeah, but my parents were supposed to be perfect because this story's about me, right? And these parents could never be the idol that's been fashioned. How many parents complain about their own children? They bemoan that their children aren't better, and when they do it, they have to reference other kids. Sometimes you don't have to reference kids, you reference yourself. Many of us, we have children, and we think, well, they're supposed to be adults, just shorter, right? They make all the good decisions, they're not annoying, they do what they're told, they don't have free will, right? But then they lack social skills, and they're needy, and they cry instead of talk, and what are you doing? You have an idea of what a child should be, and you can't even see your child because you have an icon, an idol in your mind that nobody could ever live up to. If we make images that give us a false sense of control over God, then obviously we'll do it with the people around us. If we're willing to do it with the eternal God, of course we do it to people. We walk around claiming to see people, but we don't even see them anymore. We look and there's a template. So all we can see is this vague representation of what ought to be, and then the subsequent failure. If we do it with God, of course we do it to others. And so when God commands, don't have idols, don't carve things that are supposed to be me. It means a lot of things, but not least of which, it means don't become the kind of people that create well-defined projections of your own mind and then point at it and say, that's reality. You will never experience love. You will walk around trying to control things, frustrated that you can't. And someday, hopefully, you're finally going to realize, oh, you can't control something and love it. You can't control somebody and love them. You can't be constantly trying to get them to bend their will to you and be loving them the way that God created us to love each other. If you'll do it to God, you'll do it to people. And you will be a lonely, bitter, frustrated person. And your Father in heaven doesn't want that life for you. How many of our relationships have tension in them? And the real issue is you can't even see them anymore. You see failed expectations. You carry around idols of how God and people and life should be, and none of it matches, and you're frustrated, and you don't even realize it. How many relationships would be better if you let go and dropped idols and let reality just be reality? Because the second command rids us of anxiety. It rids us of that. Detaching us from things we've attached ourselves to and reconnects us to the eternal. The mystery, some of the ambiguity, the humility of the eternal. Jesus is having a conversation with Nicodemus, and he says this in John chapter 3. I tell you the truth, nobody can see the kingdom of God unless they're born again or born from above. That's a rebirth. And he says, the wind blows wherever it pleases. You hear its sound, but you can't tell where it comes from or where it's going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. Spirit and wind are the same Greek word. The root is pneuma. Wind, spirit, breath. This is how Jesus teaches about God. I mean, if anybody's going to have some really locked down, easy to understand theology about what God is like. It'd be the Son of God. Give it to us. It's like wind with will. And people who are born from above, who are born again, they release all their notions, all their templates, and they live in the flow of the Spirit. They celebrate the unknowing. They try to see things for how they really are. And the next chapter, Jesus is having a conversation with a Samaritan woman. Samaritans had separated themselves from the Jews thousands of years ago. And Jesus is having a conversation with a Samaritan woman at a well, and they're talking about thirst and satisfaction and life and where this whole thing heads. And she kind of has this aha moment in John chapter 4. She says, "Sir, I see that you're a prophet. Our fathers from the Samaritan group, we worship on this mountain. But you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. And so we think it's this thing. You guys say it's this thing. And it's this thought and these fathers. But you say it's these thoughts and these fathers and this place." Jesus declared, "Believe me, woman, the time is coming when you'll worship the Father neither on this mountain or in Jerusalem. Your Samaritans worship what you don't know. And we're worshiping what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews." What you miss in English is there's a pun. Jesus, speaking Hebrew, would have said, when he said salvation, the word in Hebrew is Yeshua, his name. "For we know Yeshua is from the Jews. But a time is coming, and really is right in front of you. It's now come when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit," pneuma, wind, breath, "spirit and truth," aletheia. "For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth." They must worship in the mystery and the unpredictability, the vulnerability of the Spirit, and aletheia means uncovering. That's what the word, it's translated truth, that's what it really means. The unveiling. Raw, naked, strip back all your preconceived notions, strip everything away, all your ought to be's, all the ways that it's maybe presented itself, things you've gotten used to, the template that you have gotten used to, strip all that away and just stare right in the face what's actually true. I can't control that. I can't make myself get comfortable with it based on its performance or it, just what is real. Uncovered, raw, vulnerable, naked truth. The true worshipers that God's looking for are people who will live in his unpredictable flow, stop trying to regain control, and allow things to be what they are because they recognize the only thing that you and I can control is yourself. That's it. And that's a task in and of itself. That's it. Spirit and truth. Being born again is being naked and vulnerable and open to love God as he is and love people as they are before they change a single thing and conform to my comforts and my will. To love them as they are and to let go of all my preconceived notions about what they should be before they earn my love and my respect, my attention, my awe, my fidelity. To let go of all of that. Spirit and truth, it's a lifestyle unthreatened by the discomfort of ignorance. Just let people be people. Let people be messy. Let them live outside your comforting preferences. And don't demand that God be easy. I want to challenge us in closing as we leave this place. I want to challenge you. Watch how you have demands on people. When your mother, father, sibling, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, teacher, employer, employee, whoever it is, whoever walks into your life, see if you can even see them anymore. Or see if you're actually looking at your own projection of what they ought to be and how they failed that. Watch how you have demands on people and how you can't even see your own. You can't see past your demands. Watch how you have demands on God. Feeling frustrated, feeling disappointed, feeling like God has failed somehow. See if you have demands on what God should be versus the spirit, the unpredictable spirit that he is, that Jesus teaches us. Watch the demands that you have on life and how life has to treat you better for you to remain happy and faithful. Watch how many idols you carve and how much control you've convinced yourself that you need in order to be happy. And just becoming aware of these demands, these little inward idols that you have, these templates that you use for God and for everybody else that you cannot see past. Watch how every, you can't drop them all at once. Never happen. If you try it, you'll pick them all back up. But one by one, as you're aware of them and you drop them, peace comes into the gap. Anxiety goes with the idol. Peace comes into the gap. And you actually learn to love people and love God before they become lovable. You can respect. You can walk with. You can serve before they align with your idol, your preferences, your template. May we accept Jesus' invitation to live in spirit and in truth, and to watch that we don't create idols with our hands or our minds, so that we may actually live in peace and love each other. Go in peace. I'll see you next week.